ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Main engine start.
I remember the day so clearly.
One liftoff.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
I ran outside as fast as I could and looked up in the sky.
Couldn't believe it. It had exploded.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
We're going to tell you the story of Challenger.
Challenger Legacy. Search for Science Friction wherever you get your podcasts.
Or on the ABC Listen app.
So Priya, have you had many patients? I mean, it used to be said that GPs used to dread patients coming in with reams and reams of Dr. Google searches. Have you had many people coming in with AI searches?
I have now, and I feel like it's a completely different entity to Dr. Google, because people are getting quite specific advice from these AI systems.
The question is just how safe they are.
Have you used it? Have you used any of them?
No, I meant to try one, but I haven't done it. I don't trust AI. So
neither, yeah.
You know, give them something and they take it away. I have used, I must say, what I have used is AI for literature searches. So in other words, instead of Google Scholar, I use some AI proprietary programs, and with mixed results. Even them, I don't trust in terms of their summaries. It's a problem.
Despite our decades between us, you and I are on the same page on this one.
My God.
I'm also very nervous to plug in my data. I don't know where it goes. And we did do a call out for people's experiences with AI when it comes to their health concerns, their questions. And people have written in. There's a huge number of emails, and some people are really loving it. Some people find that there are potentially some traps and you have to ask the right question of the AI. But it is being widely used, and I think ChatGPT Health is certainly going to make it more widespread.
And we'll be covering more of that on today's Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land. On this AI in Health, we talked to one of the leading experts in AI in healthcare in Australia, Professor Enrico Cuera. And here's one of the things that he said.
What they say in Silicon Valley is move fast and break things. And the problem is things in healthcare are people.
That was a big sigh there, Priya.
I know. It's something I'm very nervous about, and I'm worried about patients and what's going to happen here.
Just hold your horses and listen to Enrico. Mind, I'm not sure that you're going to have your mind settled when you do hear Enrico, but that's not all we've got on today's show.
No, so we're talking about medical abortion, which in Australia is currently capped at 9 weeks of gestation, but new research suggests it could be an option for women much later in pregnancy.
And we launch a defence of the fat cell. People are having liposuction all over the place, or used to be having liposuction before GLP-1s, but the fat cell might be worth having.
In the news this week, the Minister for Health, Mark Butler, has announced that there's going to be the development of a national medicines record. So essentially all scripts that are dispensed, prescribed, are going to go into a national database, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, this stems from problems with telehealth providers, where you phone up your doctor or make an appointment and you say what's wrong with you and they give you a script without seeing you.
Yes, so online services, where there's been acknowledgement with this announcement that there has been a disconnect in the care of patients. So either regular GP will see patients, and they will actually sometimes tell me, Norman, that maybe they're taking some form of medicinal cannabis or a GLP-1. Those are the two that I'm commonly seeing. And if the patient tells me amazing, if they don't, then I am not aware of it. And it can cause problems and interactions with other medicines and other treatment.
And this all stems from the advocacy of one mother whose daughter died from a medicines overdose, from doctor shopping through these digital health providers.
Yes, and she stockpiled medications and tragically did overdose, which was preventable.
Two things that confuse me about this, but you as a practicing GP can probably fix me up, is first of all, my health record stores the prescribing records that, you know, if you prescribe something, it automatically goes into my health record. And also, there's a national system for controlled medications like narcotics, isn't there, where there's a flag?
So that's a two-part question, I feel.
Okay.
Dr. Norman Swan.
And here's your starter for five. Yeah. Answer the first part.
The My Health record is often incomplete, and it depends on whether or not practitioners actually upload information to it. So it's dependent on that. It doesn't always happen automatically. The second is that,
you've got to actively look for it.
You do. And often I go in there and, Norman, it's incomplete. So it's actually unhelpful and sometimes confusing. The real-time prescribing does exist for certain medications. So if I'm prescribing medication for ADHD or a benzodiazepine, certain regulated medications, I can log on to in Victoria, it's called SafeScript, and I can see who's prescribed and who has dispensed the medications. And it's only for a very limited number of medications. And I think expanding that to everything to avoid this kind of interactions or people potentially overdosing, which is preventable, is going to be really quite a powerful thing.
And initially it's going to be for these telehealth providers.
Yes, they will be enforced to upload. And actually the interesting thing is not just the medication, but the context, the reason for the medication being prescribed. It's one thing to just see the medication, but to actually know what the clinical indication is also really important.
And good news on the uptake of the shingles vaccine.
Yes, so people will remember that in November 2023, before my time with you, Norman, there was a different shingles vaccine.
Before,
that was
which time? Or your health report
time? Before we were together on the health report.
We were a thing.
Yes. There used to be a vaccine called Zostavax. That was the live shingles vaccine, which we couldn't use in immunocompromised people.
And it wasn't very effective anyway.
Yes, and then it got replaced with Shingrix, which is what is currently on the schedule. You get two doses. It's not live. We can use it in immunocompromised patients. And also,
the age has gone down.
And it's much more effective. But they've just released data on the uptake of it, which is good news.
A third of the program's eligible adults, that's people aged over 65, 65 or over, have received at least one Shingrix dose. But it's really not evenly spread across Australia or even by gender. So women are taking up more than men, you know, and there are regional differences.
And I think it's also important to note that nearly 88% of those who started the course went on to complete the second dose, which is they have that two dose level of protection. And you're right, there is still discrepancies in terms of who's able to access it. But this is just a nice reminder for people. Shingles is very unpleasant. You can develop a condition called post-herpetic neuralgia with chronic pain. It can be quite debilitating. So if you're over 65, if you're Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander 50 and over, or you're immunocompromised and over 18, go and chat to a health professional.
And you've got the added benefit of 17 to 20% reduction in the incidence of dementia.
Yes. We love going on about that.
We do.
Should we do it again? It could be due to the adjuvant. It could be due to preventing infection.
Well, it happens with influenza vaccine and it probably happens with pneumococcal vaccine too. Something about getting vaccinated protects your brain.
It's the way to go.
And just a follow up to, we had a conversation last week about cannabis. A big review of cannabis, you know, in various forms to treat chronic pain. And what it showed was, whether it's THC, CBD, or a mix of THC and CBD, there's no evidence that it produces anything greater than a 50% reduction in pain relief, which is considered the minimum required for significance.
And the authors did acknowledge that the studies that existed, that exist, I guess, in this space, are really quite small. Some of them are biased, and that really there need to be larger studies and randomised controlled trials in this area. But yeah, for the moment, very limited, if not lack of evidence.
And importantly, the other thing, that there's a serious lack of evidence about the side effects. And it must be said that you and I are not necessarily popular when it comes to talking about cannabis.
No. So we did do a post on ABC Radio National on Instagram. You and I occasionally appear on there.
Mm.
And, you know, I still consider myself quite cool and open-minded, but people, you know, I think at the end of the day, we are here to dissect the evidence and give people reliable information. And unfortunately, in this space, like you do you, we're just here to help people make informed decisions, are we not, Norman?
We are. We don't have to be super cool.
No, but you also don't have to listen to us if you don't want to.
No, maybe you can listen to us because you're taking too much THC. I mean, who knows? You know, just don't drive.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
Super cool. So, Priya, a lot in the news this week about ChatGPT, health and AI. Some people say taking over the diagnostics. The AI people tell us that it's not about that. It's only about help. What's your take on all this?
I'm very interested with the release of ChatGPT Health, and I know that a lot of people are already turning to it and people can now sign up to request access for this service. I have a lot of, I guess, concerns and reluctance as a GP. I wonder how it's going to impact clinical practice.
Do you think it's going to do you out of a job?
I don't think do me out of a job, but I think people already rely on things like Google, and I think this may change the landscape yet again. it would be ignorant to think that this isn't going to change the game.
But it is commercial. You know, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts.
No, they're not. So there is money in it for them. And I just wonder what happens to people's data. How safe is it? Is it regulated like a medical device? And I guess to answer all of those questions, we have an expert, Professor Enrico Coiera, who's the director for the Centre of Health Informatics at Macquarie University. Welcome, Enrico.
Hi there.
I guess the key question is, how safe is it if people are putting in their health questions and their data into any AI service like ChatGPT Health?
Look, it's a really difficult question to answer because we know so little about these new products. People say, you know, years go by and nothing happens, and then a week goes by and years happen. And we've seen these products appear out of nowhere, really, in the last couple of years. So normally, if I'm using anything in healthcare, there's evidence behind it, research evidence. And what we find with all these new chat products, whether it's ChatGPT or Amazon or Google, is that there's no formal regulatory process they've gone through. So Australia's TGA doesn't say it's good or it's bad. And they don't necessarily publish enough data to give us confidence that they are safe. So if you use these products, you will be impressed by them. I mean, they are often very good, very accurate, but not always is the issue. Mm. And so in healthcare, we need to be not 85% correct. We want to be 99.99% correct.
Do we know where they get trained? I mean, we know that ChatGPT gets trained on the millions of books that have ever been written, you know, with enormous controversy. I mean, have they just ingested Harrison's textbook of medicine and Bailey's textbook of surgery? Or, you know, have they got access to medical records? Has the Mayo Clinic been trained? I mean, what do we know about how ChatGPT Health has been trained?
What we are told is that it's health specific. So it would have been trained on guidelines, journal articles, those websites you mentioned like Mayo, as well as presumably lots and lots of conversations about healthcare. So
maybe even the health report.
Possibly. But if you think about it, every week ChatGPT looks at something like 230 million queries that are just healthcare related. So that's a huge amount of information that presumably goes into the model also.
So they've said, OpenAI have said, Enrico, that ChatGPT Health won't use the data collected to train foundation models. But what does happen to the data that someone pops into this service? People upload their blood results, their images, information from their fitness app trackers. Where does it go? Is it safe?
What they say is that they guarantee that it's secure and private, which is fantastic. Secure means it's not going to get hacked. And private means that only the people you want to see it, see it.
But that's taken on good faith, isn't it?
It's all on good faith. And there are a lot of weasel words in there in the sense that there are lots of other uses they could put those data to. They could use it to on sell to a pharmaceutical company. They could use it to personalize products that you get advertised to you. There's no barrier to that. So usually what I say, and this is nothing to do with any specific product, is you need to be very clear about where the data are being kept. And I'm a strong believer that the data needs to be residing in Australia, subject to Australian laws. If the data is being held by OpenAI in the US, then US laws hold, which are very different in terms of protections.
So before we get to AI, what do we know, for example, in the good old days, like 3 weeks ago, of the reliability of Dr. Google? Because there has been some research into that.
So Google is AI. It's been AI for a long time. It's just a different kind of AI. And it's never been clinical grade in the sense that it will always do pretty well. But Google works by giving you a collection of information that might be correct. So hopefully in the 5 or 10 documents you get, you might see what you want. What we're doing now is something quite different, which is synthesizing an answer out of all those documents. So it was the use model of Google that made it safe in a sense that you had to go and look at all those documents. Now we don't have that filter anymore.
So when the AI health service gives you an answer, Enrico, and I've never used it, I'm declaring that, if you plug in your symptoms and it gives you solutions or a diagnosis, does it give you references? Does it give you the stuff to look at to see potentially how reliable the information it's giving you is?
So that will depend on which company's product you're using, but usually they'll have links that you can click on But the challenge is the person reading it in a position to be able to read that and understand it and to be rational about it? So if it's 2 a.m. and I'm panicked about a health symptom or sign, I may not be in a good situation to assess those links. Really what you want to do is to chat to a health professional to say whether or not you should be worried or not. So it's an artificial setting, really, where you're putting information into a computer. You're not engaging with others to help you problem solve.
Talking about settings, because there's so many overlaps here. So you've got nurse on call, doctor on call, the federal government's investing on GPs being available on telephone lines, and they're using algorithms which presumably have a bit of AI in them as well. And the assumption has been in the past that if you've got nurse on call, it actually unloads off emergency departments. But the early experience of that was, in fact, it increased demand on emergency departments because the risk adjustment on the algorithm that the nurses were using wasn't prepared to take a risk. And the idea is having doctors there is that doctors are better at risk adjusting and perhaps saving people unnecessary four-hour waits in casualty. Have we got any idea here whether these AI systems risk adjust?
No, we don't. And we don't even really know how they're built. So we know generally the technologies that go into them, but the so-called tweaks and guardrails and optimizations they put in are all proprietary. So it's all black box. All you can really do is look at their impact once they're in real-world use. And as I've said, there's scarce evidence about that. And that really is, for me, one of the concerns, which is it's moving so fast, well ahead of regulation, well ahead of legislation, well ahead of the evidence, that we don't really know this world we're bringing in. I'm optimistic in the sense that I think these technologies have great promise, but it's going very, very fast.
One of the things we spoke about just before you came on was the new system for a national record of prescriptions. Is there any sense that you could give permission to these AI systems to access your personal prescription record or your MyHealth record?
Yes, at the moment, there's no connection that's available, and they're still stitching up all the different data sources now to put them into MyHealth record. There's nothing stopping a future government allowing that to happen, and you would hope that if that did happen, then there will be strong protections.
Enrico, I just wondered, you mentioned before that currently these AI devices aren't regulated by the TGA. I'm assuming they're not considered medical devices at the moment. Do you think there's a point at which that will change as we start to see how they behave in the real world and the potential implications?
So the TGA has been very clear that if software participates in diagnosis or therapy recommendation, it is a medical device and it should be regulated. Although if you read on the ChatGPT health page, it says it's not providing advice. It still does provide that information. So you would probably argue that these are medical devices. It's what happened with Uber, really, where Uber came in early where there was no regulation around that sort of service. There was old taxi services that were being competed with, and they just moved so fast that they evaded regulation. And my worry is that it's sort of an Uber move again, where they move in very quickly, own the territory to a point where we can't avoid not working with them and then allow them in terms of legislation.
What's the overlap with the clinical situation? A lot of GPs are using what are called AI scribes. They listen to the conversation. They take notes that are more comprehensive than the GP would, being very popular. But what's being thought of as an adjunct to that and probably undeveloped is AI systems, which then link to the other records that might have been had over the last 6 months, medical tests and pathology tests, and saying to the doctor, have you thought this might be pancreatic cancer, for example? What's the overlap here, if any?
It's very analogous. And again, the TGA, Australia's regulator, has been very clear that if the scribe system does that, it should be regulated. It is considered a medical device. And so there's a bit of to-ing and fro-ing at the moment where the people are trying to avoid that costly process. But I think the evidence is clear that the moment you start to provide advice or guidance, you need to be regulated.
Which, let's be honest, these devices do that. I have patients come in and tell me that ChatGPT told them to do this, this and this, and they've already implemented things and then they come and see me. So it does feel like they are giving quite a bit of advice to patients already. So let's see. Watch this space, I guess.
Exactly. It's just moving so fast, guys. Mm. What they say in Silicon Valley is move fast and break things. And the problem is things in healthcare are people.
Enrico, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Professor Enrico Correa, who's director of the Centre for Health Informatics at Macquarie University. And we've had a few emails.
We have had a few emails on this topic, and I think we need to acknowledge, Norman, and we didn't cover it in the chat with Enrico, that people are clearly turning to AI for reason. They have reasons to go there, and it might be that they cannot afford to go and see a health professional. Perhaps they are in a regional area. They've felt dismissed before. They've not felt heard and seen in a consult. So we have to acknowledge that there's reasons why people go here.
Or it's 3 o'clock in the morning and they don't want to wait for 4 hours in an emergency department.
That's right, and it's easier to go on your phone. But we did get lots of emails, and people have said, so Duncan has said, I'm trying to be very measured in my responses and recognise this is not a substitute for medical advice.
Acer says, of course, like in all areas of life, this is subject to the quandary of ask the right question and get the right answer. That's absolutely right. Mm. It really depends on the question you ask.
Marika says it gave her a 3-step morning and 3-step evening routine for her psoriasis, and says after 6 weeks, my psoriasis around my eyelids disappeared. Also, my skin has never looked better.
Well done, Marika. Yeah. And the answer is I get clear answers and I'm reassured that these symptoms are real and they're not just in my head. I'm no longer in the dark about why I've been referred for certain tests or the meaning of medical terms. I'm building up health literacy and can ask my GP or specialist more useful and relevant questions. It's interesting, I was listening to Life Matters on this topic with Tegan Taylor, and in fact, the representative of the Australian Medical Association argued that this was one of the benefits of AI in health, is that you had a more meaningful conversation with your GP and used the time with your GP more productively.
And there was actually a study done in 2024 which looked at how many people were using AI for health reasons. And in fact, people who are English as a second language, who don't speak English at home, these people were more likely to actually use AI instead. And I think for some people it may actually help improve health literacy and perhaps navigate the medical world, which is a bonus. But as we've heard from Enrico, there are also a lot of potential risks here. And if Enrico is nervous, Norman, so am I.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're in an AI-free zone with the Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Coming up, the fat cell has had a bad rap for years. Goodness knows how many billions of fat cells have been flushed down the sink after liposuction. Today, we restore the fat cell's reputation as something we can't do without.
When it comes to abortion in Australia, there are various options. People can consider medical abortion up to 9 weeks of gestation. So that's where you take a combination of tablets. For some women, it's much safer and psychologically better for them to do it at home, where they don't need to have an anaesthetic or go into hospital. And there's the option of surgical abortion as well, where you do need to go into hospital and have some form of sedation or anaesthetic. There's a recent study from the British Medical Journal that's looked at medical abortion beyond 10 weeks and how effective and safe it is. And really the question is, should this be an option for women in Australia beyond the 9-week mark that we currently have? I spoke to Professor Daniel Matzer, who leads the Centre of Excellence in Sexual and Reproductive Health for Women in Primary Care.
Medical abortion can be provided through general practice. So it involves taking MS two-step, which is a combination of mifepristone and misoprostol, two medications, to bring about a medically induced miscarriage. And currently, MS two-step is registered for use up until 9 weeks gestation, which is quite early on in a pregnancy, and which means that in order to be able to access medical abortion, women have to move quite quickly from the time that they find out that they're pregnant to making a decision as to whether they want to proceed with an abortion and then finding a provider who will prescribe the medication to them and follow them through the process.
You've said there's not much time, so someone might find out that they're pregnant at maybe 7 weeks potentially. How easy is it to find someone who can potentially prescribe this medication?
Well, navigating to a provider is probably the most complex part of the whole process because we don't have very good systems in place in Australia to assist either women out in the community or providers actually to know where they can refer to. Probably around 10% of GPs in Australia are currently providing this service. It's slowly been increasing, but only recently, since deregulation in 2023, has it become easier for GPs and other health practitioners like nurse practitioners to provide this service.
What about women living in regional communities who are thousands of kilometres away from a scanner or a provider, sorry? What about women who are from culturally diverse backgrounds? If it's hard anyway, is it even more difficult? Are there barriers to actually accessing this as a service?
Well, there are a lot of barriers. So firstly, even knowing that medical abortion is an option. Traditionally, abortion has been carried out surgically, requiring kind of a day stay in a surgical hospital facility. And medical abortion has become more prevalent, but knowledge about what a medical abortion actually is pretty low out in the community, and even lower in our priority populations, such as amongst adolescents or amongst women from different ethnic backgrounds where English might not be their first language. And so they may have added difficulty in knowing about a medical abortion and knowing about the gestational limit. Also, many women may not know about the option of having a telehealth abortion, which is a relatively recent innovation in Australia that came about really after COVID. Say, if a woman is in Western Australia, they could access potentially an abortion from a GP or a doctor in Queensland or in Victoria.
So you've mentioned there surgical abortion and medical abortion. So surgical being you go into a hospital setting and you require sedation or anaesthetic. Why would someone choose a medical abortion instead? Can you just talk us through what kinds of things people consider when they're making that decision of which option to go with?
A medical abortion might be much more convenient for women who can time when they take the medication and when they actually experience the abortion itself, with the accompanying bleeding and often pain that goes with it. So many might want to do that, for example, on a weekend or when they have a carer on hand to support them. And for many women, the convenience of undergoing a medical abortion in the privacy of their own home is a much more attractive option than travelling and paying potentially higher costs out of pocket to access surgical abortion.
So there's a study from Scotland, Danielle, that's been published in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, suggesting that medical abortion at home is safe and should be an option for women up to 11 weeks. So quite a bit beyond the 9 weeks limit that we currently have here in Australia. Where are we at in terms of the 9 week limit? Do you think that with time, with more evidence, that may eventually push out to give women this option for a bit longer?
Yes, so medical abortion can actually happen at much later gestations than 9 weeks. In Europe, for example, GPs in Ireland are conducting medical abortion routinely in the community right up until 12 weeks. So we've got this kind of artificial limit of 9 weeks in Australia. We do have currently pending an application to extend the gestational limit in Australia up until 10 weeks. And in fact, our recently released Australia and New Zealand guidelines recommend medical abortion up to 10 weeks in the community, which is also a routine in New Zealand. So I think eventually our gestational limit in Australia will be extended, but we're not quite there yet.
I just wondered, in Ireland, where the GPs are doing medical abortion up to 12 weeks, are there higher rates of failure of people needing to go into the surgical abortion pathway because it fails? Or is it quite successful?
It's quite successful, and that's because they have more readily accessible misoprostol and can give increased doses of that medication should it be required to complete the abortion process.
Danielle, do you think that the attitudes towards abortion generally are changing?
Deregulation has helped to destigmatise abortion amongst health professionals. We do have in several states legislation around conscientious objection that may require people who don't want to provide an abortion themselves to refer on to a service that does. And increasingly around the country, family planning clinics and other sexual health services are providing medical abortion, and state-based telehealth providers are springing up to ensure that women can get access to this essential service when they need it.
Professor Daniel Matzer, Head of the Department of General Practice at Monash University and Director of the Sphere Centre of Research Excellence.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. Now, in these days of GLP-1 agonists, raising the sign of the cross to obesity, you'd think that the fat cell just has taken on this almost the notion of the devil in our bodies, that these fat cells contain stuff that's really bad for us and we should abolish them forever. Before GLP-1s came along, there was an active industry in sucking the fat cells out. But maybe it's time for restoring the reputation of the fat cell. And I spoke to somebody quite recently who was visiting Australia who is a world authority on the fat cell.
I'm Professor Stephen O'Rahilly. I'm Professor of Clinical Biochemistry and Medicine at the University of Cambridge.
So you're here to resurrect the reputation of the fat cell.
I am a poor, neglected cell. We often think of it as an evil baddie, but of course it has jobs to do. It's really bad not to have fat cells. There's a condition called lipodystrophy, people who either have no fat cells or inadequate fat cells.
And those, in fact, it's one of the side effects of some HIV treatment.
It is indeed, yeah. And that's a very difficult and dangerous condition. So we really need our fat cells to be healthy.
So what happens when you've got no fat cells?
So the normal job of a fat cell is to take any extra calories we have and neatly package it away in those professional cells. They're designed to be energy stores. If we don't have them, then the energy has to go somewhere. And it goes to places that are not professional. It goes to places like muscle, liver, the artery linings, and fat goes in there and causes all sorts of mischief. It interferes with how insulin works. It predisposes to diabetes, predisposes to heart disease, predisposes to severe liver disease. Many of the patients with lipodystrophy get fatty liver, and that fatty liver leads to cirrhosis, even sometimes liver cancer.
So fat cells, if you like, are a buffer.
A buffer. A perfect, that's a very good word for them. They're a buffer for energy. They're like a battery. If our sun is on and we're storing energy in a battery, that's where we store the energy in our bodies.
So let's go back to basics. It used to be said that you were born with a certain number of fat cells and that was it. And if you were lucky enough to have careful nutrition as a child, you were well set up for the future. Do we have a set number of fat cells?
We probably have a set range, but we don't have a stable number of, they're not like our brain cells. I mean, our brain cells are the number that we were born with. And scientists in Stockholm have recently shown that basically we turn over about 10% of our fat cells per year.
So we have stem cells for fat cells?
We have stem cells for fat cells.
Where do they live?
They live within the fat tissue itself, and they don't look like fat cells, but then they can become committed to becoming fat cells. And really the characteristic of a fat cell is it stores lipid, the triglyceride, the type of fat, in a big droplet in the fat cell. And it needs specialized machinery to do that.
But more and more, people are talking about the fat cell or fat tissue in the body as what doctors would call an endocrine organ. In other words, like the thyroid gland or the pancreas, it produces hormones. So it's far more than just a storage center.
It does many jobs. It does a very important insulating job. It does a job like bubble wrap. I mean, behind your eyes, the delicate tissues behind their eyes are wrapped in fat so that your delicate vessels and nerves are protected. Under your heel, there's a very specialized fat pad so it's not painful to walk. Fat has many functions. Its particular endocrine function is that it produces a hormone called leptin, which keeps the brain informed about how the state of the battery storage, if you like, is. So your brain knows that you've got enough fat stored through this hormone leptin.
Why did leptin fail as a drug to control weight?
So leptin did not fail. What leptin is a magnificent drug for children who totally lack leptin. It's totally transformative. And we, many years ago, treated the first children who had no leptin.
So these kids with Prader-Willi syndrome?
No. These are children with congenital leptin deficiency. They are born with no leptin gene, and they are born with no leptin.
Which means they've got no control over appetite.
They have no control over their appetite. They are monstrously hungry. Their entire lives are dominated by the drive to eat food. And we were fortunate enough to find the first such children back in the late 1990s and the first to give leptin to them. And it's remarkable. Within a matter of days, the appetite is completely transformed. You essentially restore them to a normal life. The first child we treated with leptin all those years ago is now in her 30s. She's had two children. She's a pharmacist. She would never know that she was in any way abnormal. But yet she was vastly obese as a child. So leptin works brilliantly in those conditions. It also works if you have no fat tissue. If you have total lipodystrophy, you lack the fat, but you also lack the leptin. leptin, those unfortunate children, although they're not obese, are ravenously hungry. You give back leptin to them and that greatly improves their appetite.
But for common or garden obesity?
For common or garden obesity, the answer is not quite as simple as a flat no, because what happened was it was trialled very quickly with a rather dirty form of leptin. The metreleptin that was made at the time was a bit hard to dissolve. It was large volumes. It was not a great formulation of leptin. And if you look at the data in some detail, the individuals who had the lower level of leptin, the ordinary obese people who are on the low side for leptin, they did show a response. It just wasn't considered commercially viable at the time because it didn't work across the way. If you had a highish leptin, it didn't work so well.
So coming back to this idea that it's more than just a fat cell, where does the fat cell fit into atherosclerosis, the disease of arteries which causes heart attacks and strokes?
Okay, so that link is a several-step link, because my view is a little bit different from those of some other scientists. So there's some scientists and quite a few who would argue that what happens is that you get expanded fat cells, you get inflammation in fat tissue, and it's the inflammation in the fat tissue that's bad for arteries.
And it's thought to be bad for the brain and other organs too, speed up aging.
Speed up aging. My view is that while the inflammatory process may be important in certain contexts, more damaging is the attempt by cells that are not fat cells to try and handle the lipids, the free fatty acids, the species of fat that should normally be handled by the fat cell. If you get obese and you overwhelm your capacity to store safely in your adipose tissue, there are plenty of people who are very, very obese who don't get any complications of obesity because they seem to have an infinite capacity to store safely. It's really when you reach the top limits of your safe storage and you start redirecting the lipids, you redirect it into liver. And when you start redirecting it into liver, you start making these so-called atherogenic particles, the lipoprotein particles that circulate around that bring the bad cholesterol and other types of toxic lipid, the so-called remnant cholesterol, and they then start going into the macrophages in the vessel wall and predispose to atherosclerosis. I'm afraid it is a complex multi-step process, but I think fat in the wrong place is at the heart of most of the problems that we're dealing with.
But fat cells have also been blamed for cancer.
Yeah, obesity is associated with cancer.
Is that the fat cell?
I do not think that is the fat cell.
Oh, you're a real friend of the fat cell, aren't you? You're fat cell's best friend.
You may well have asked me what the fat cell is bad. I think there are mechanical and gravitational consequences of obesity. So I think some things that go wrong in obesity are due to the expanded fat mass. For example, if you have a huge visceral tummy, huge belly, and increased intra-abdominal pressure, then the reflux esophagitis that you get, and then the increased risk of esophageal cancer is almost certainly partly related to simply the mass of fat that's pressing and causing
pressure. So where does
pressure.
The cancer risk come from?
The cancer risk comes from reflux esophagitis.
You understand that with esophageal cancer, but yeah. Talk about breast cancer and other forms of cancer.
So I do not think it's a direct result of the fat mass in those conditions. Breast is not a great example because there's very controversial data on the association of obesity and breast cancer. In fact, some studies show that obesity is protective against premenopausal breast cancer, not causative. And it's only the risk looks at this with postmenopausal breast cancer. So the breast cancer is not a great example of a cancer-obesity link. Much stronger.
Pancreas?
No, a little bit in pancreas, yes. The strongest ones are colon and endometrial, particularly womb cancer.
Uterine.
Yeah. Uterine cancer, endometrial cancer. They are the strongest link. And to me, the data looks most compelling is that you become metabolically sick because of obesity. You become insulin resistant. Your insulin levels rise. And insulin, although it's not a great growth factor, it's a strong anti-cell survival factor. High insulin levels look very strongly associated with endometrial cancer. And there are good animal models where you reverse the insulin resistance and you reduce the endometrial proliferation. So I think that the sequence of events is obesity, ectopic fat, insulin resistance, high insulin as a compensation from the pancreas, and then that predisposes to the, and the colon. So in both of those, I think that's a pretty reasonable hypothesis for why obesity is associated with it.
So you were, given that you're a close friend of the fat cell, are you worried in any way about the use of GLP-1 agonists?
No, because they don't remove fat cells. They just make the fat cells smaller. So you can imagine if you have set number of N fat cells and they're just smaller after GLP-1, they're perfectly capable of growing again if you overeat and they come down. So that's a healthy wave. So health is fat cells that are not overstuffed with lipid. And that's what GLP-1 does. For example, if you do a thought experiment about doing such massive liposuction that you removed somebody 80% of their fat cells, that will be very bad for you in a way that GLP-1 is not very bad for you.
There's increasing research into what they call crosstalk. Mm-hmm. So muscles talk to the gut, the gut talks to the brain, the muscles talk to the brain. What's the crosstalk involving fat?
So that's my sweet spot is I'm an endocrinologist. I love hormones. I mean, hormones are magnificent creatures. I describe them as like little rowing boats that you send across the... They're so important. They carry crucial messages through the roiling sea of the bloodstream. So I'm in love with hormones. And so it was fantastic when the fat cell turned out also to be a hormonal-producing cell. Now, really, the only one that's absolutely clear is leptin. That is the only hormone that directly comes from adipocytes and acts on other tissues. But fat responds to a panoply of hormones, insulin being the most important. I mean, as soon as you eat, insulin goes up and insulin hits the fat cell and stops it breaking down fat immediately. Then there are others. Adrenaline increases the release of that.
From and the microbiome?
The microbiome. My own personal view of the microbiome is a bit like Gandhi said about Western civilization, too early to tell.
So the bottom line is love your fat cells.
Love your fat cells to a certain extent, because if without them, you're really sick. So they're not all bad.
Just don't load them up too much.
Don't load them up too much.
Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Stephen O'Rahilly, Professor of Clinical Biochemistry and Medicine at the University of Cambridge. Never will I say a bad word about the fat cell ever again.
We've learned our lesson. We love you, fat cell.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. What's in the mailbag?
So we did a story last week on breast density reporting and the potential psychological impact on women who find out that they've got dense breasts and then they're subjected to either more screening or told they need to do things differently.
And that's because dense breasts might miss a cancer or delay the diagnosis.
We got one email, and this was not in a screening situation, so we should be very clear that we were talking in the context of screening, mammography and breast density reporting, but this person's written in saying that they'd found a lump and that if I had been advised about my dense breasts and the much higher risk and difficulty in seeing them on tests, I would have fought for more attention and testing and pushed for what I should have received instead of being patted on the head for 3 to 4 years and now in the dire situation that I'm now in. So unfortunately, this person's been diagnosed with breast cancer subsequently.
And this is the flip side of creating anxiety about dense breasts, not knowing what to do about it. And that's the flip side, is that the risk is real.
I actually had several people direct message me on Instagram. I don't know if you know there's an inbox on there, Norman. But just on the flip side, people were saying that they felt quite validated hearing the interview last week because they had felt quite anxious knowing their breast density from their screening mammogram and having the discussions that had come as a result of that. And so I think we need to be aware that for some people, they want to know everything when it comes to their health. Some people don't want to know everything, particularly if you can't action it or do anything about it or afford the subsequent tests that are required. And just remembering that email we got was in a completely different context to screening. So diagnostic and screening are very different forms of imaging. And if you have a lump or any symptoms, you're not going to the screening mammogram place. You're having a specialised diagnostic scan, which is entirely different.
And that goes for any cancer symptom, such as bowel cancer screening. If you've got blood in your poo, do not do the FOBT test, the screening test. You've got to go and be referred for a colonoscopy.
Yes, and we did a story on palliative care, or you did a story on palliative care last week.
And this comes from Agnes. Hello, Norman and Priya. Thank you, as always, for your informative program. I listen with excitement every week. We listen with excitement every week too. We've got no idea what's on the show. However, there's always a however. I have problems with your recent item on early palliative care. To explain what that story was, it was a study in Victoria of people who received palliative care early, which meant 90 days before they actually died, or late palliative care, which actually was in the hours before people died, showing that people did much, much better in terms of quality of life, improved end-of-life care, if they had early palliative care. And then we also discussed how it probably should be much, much earlier than 3 months, maybe even 2 years beforehand. But anyway, Agnes goes on. Firstly, how would you implement the apparent conclusion that starting palliative care at least 90 days before death leads to improved end-of-life care? You have to know when the person will die. Good point, Agnes. I prefer Norman's definition. Thanks, Agnes. I really like you already. But you start palliative care by answering the question, would it be a big surprise if the person died in the next 12 months? But that's not what this study considered. Secondly, it's well known that observational cohort studies, Agnes is hiding her light under a bushel here. She's clearly got epidemiological background. Secondly, it's well known that observational cohort studies have issues with causality. As the authors write in their paper, such designs establish associations rather than causal connections. Thirdly, a retrospective analysis can't tell you anything about the people who thought they were starting early palliative care but died quickly instead. Lots of the study's late palliative care group must have thought they were starting early. The study also, we don't actually know that, but anyway, the study also doesn't tell you anything about the people who thought they were starting late palliative care but lived more than 90 days after all. There would have been people in that category too. Good points, Agnes. Nonetheless, I do like analyses of such large data sets, but I do think we need to think about what they mean. Thank you again for your program, from which I also learn heaps and have fun too. Thank you, Agnes, because we learn a lot from emails such as yours.
We do. So please write in to us. We appreciate all of them. The address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And you don't need a PhD in public health or epidemiology to write in.
Anyone can write in.
And don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash? This week we deal with that perennial question of summer. Can you swim after your dinner?
Oh, listen, but I still will do it anyway. It's the ultimate summer treat, Norman.
See you next week.
See you then.
Well, I hope I will see you next week, unless you have a cramp in the water.
Don't wish that upon me, please.
I won't.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.